Today on the 21st, we hear personal stories about breast cancer, including my own and a fellow journalist, Madalika Sika. When she was undergoing treatment, she found it wasn't always easy to talk to her doctors.
I think, frankly, they do the best that they can, given the fact that most likely your doctor hasn't been through it.
Plus, herbicides with the chemical dicamba were supposed to get rid of the so-called super weeds all over Midwestern farms. But that hasn't exactly gone as planned. Crops, trees, and other plants across Illinois have seen more damage than usual.
I mean, we're seeing it not only in soybeans, but we're seeing it in oak trees, we're seeing it in prairies, we're seeing it in milkweed, so all different types of places.
Also, we talk state politics with NBC5's Marianne Ahern. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and I have to thank a host of people, everyone from Scott Cameron to Brian Moline to Yvonne Greer and Nova Sappho, who've been filling in for me these past few months. This is also not an encore version of the show. This is a live version of the 21st. And for regular listeners, you may have wondered where I've been. In February, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And this summer, I've been undergoing chemotherapy as part of my recovery process. That's why I haven't been on the air as much as I had initially thought I would be. While a diagnosis of breast cancer at my age is not at all common, unfortunately, women getting breast cancer is. One out of every eight women develops breast cancer over the course of their life. As it happens to be Breast Cancer Awareness Month, I would be remiss at this point if I didn't point out the importance of having a mammogram. My tumor was in fact found during the very first mammogram I ever had. I should say to everyone who's listening that I'm going to be okay, and I'm immensely grateful to all the medical professionals who continue to provide such excellent medical care to me, especially my primary care doctor, who was the one who insisted I first go get that mammogram. And it's because of that great care that I'd like to spend some time today on one issue that I feel like I've learned a lot about in the past 8 months. That's doctor-patient communication. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by two oncologists to talk about how crucial patient communication with doctors is. But first, a perspective from someone else who's been where I am, and I imagine so many women listening right now have also been. I want to welcome to the 21st, Madalika Sika. She's the author of A Breast Cancer Alphabet, and like me, she's a journalist. After many years with NPR, she's now PBS's public editor. Madalika, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Nyla. Nice to have you back on the air.
Yeah. So I was reading through your book this past weekend about when everybody who goes through cancer, their first thing is sort of when they got the call. And it's always, I got the call on Valentine's Day. So obviously every day is terrible to get a diagnosis. Valentine's Day was particularly horrible. For me, it was also the day before our very first live show we were going to do ever from Springfield. It was the day before the governor was delivering his budget address back in February. Can you tell me where you were when you found out about your diagnosis?
Sure. I was actually at the White House. I was at NPR at the time and working at Morning Edition, and Steve Inskeep was interviewing President Obama. I knew I might hear that day because I had asked my primary care physician to let me know when she heard. And we had to go into the Oval Office, and we couldn't take our cell phones with us. So, of course, you know, I had that on my mind along with whatever the president was talking about. And when I got out, I did eventually connect with my doctor who had been trying to connect with me. And she said, you know, I know these aren't the rules the way they like to do them, but she told me that my biopsy did show, in fact, that I had breast cancer. But she also said, and here is the next thing you're going to do, which I think was a really important part of that conversation.
Yeah, and I think both of us had similar experiences with that, where my primary care doctor jumped in right away and said, this is the plan, this is what we're doing. And so you write about this, right? Both of us end up in a place that no one ever wants to be, which is the place you call cancer land. That's the C in your ABCs, right?
Yep.
And unfortunately for you, this wasn't your first visit as a family there. And I wonder what you had learned about cancer land and how to talk to doctors before you became a patient yourself.
Well, I think that, you know, it's very easy to be intimidated by doctors, particularly specialists, because, you know, they're specialists and we're not. And we learned a lot about that when my mother-in-law did, in fact, have cancer and died of cancer. And we were still pretty young then. And, you know, we were married. We were professionals, but we kind of felt intimidated. So we learned a lot from going through that process of how the doctors sort of bulldozed us into things that we might not have been ready for, or we would have been ready for if they had spent 5 minutes explaining things. So then my husband was diagnosed with cancer 10 years before me, and we were just a lot better at being advocates for ourselves, which I think is a very hard thing to do.
It is a hard thing. And I think it's also, you have to be an advocate for yourself, but I think you can't do that without having the right information. And you and I approach this the same way because we're journalists and we're producers, right? So we started, you did the same thing I did. We became journalists, we prepared. And your book, the letter N is for notebook. I did this. I started doing research. I started talking to people. I started talking to other women who had gone through this. And I had a wonderful, wonderful nurse navigator who called me before my appointment with my surgeon and spent an hour on the phone sort of preparing me for what the visit was going to be like and helping me figure out questions. What did you do to prepare for when you talked to your doctors?
It's a tricky balance because, you know, if you go down the rabbit hole of the internet, you could find yourself in a very dark place. And in fact, when my husband was diagnosed,
the forums,
he had a very
yes.
rare form of cancer that I started reading, and I thought, oh my God, he's going to be dead soon, and I'm going to be a widow with two toddlers. So, you know, I think you have to balance sort of getting information from people you know and people you trust. I mean, I know it's a cliche that everyone's cancer is particular to them, but it is. So I did a combination of talking to friends who had been through it. Also, an advantage as a journalist, I went to our science desk to get information about the latest research. And then, you know, frankly, I think my best sort of partners were my doctors. You know, once I made it clear that I would be one of those people asking questions, they were actually incredibly helpful and open to answering those questions for me. And the thing you have to know is you may not be able to get an answer that is very clear for some of the things that you're asking about.
Yeah, I should mention to everybody, your husband is very healthy and great,
yes.
right? We should point that
We're
out.
Both healthy. We're both
you
healthy.
Are also both healthy. I was with you last week in Washington. You look great.
Thank you. So do you.
Thank you. But I do think that's a really important part about the information. And that was very hard for me that, and I, in fact, our executive editor, Scott Cameron, said this to me at one point. He said, as journalists, we expect clear answers. And I think this is going to be something where you're not going to get clear answers. You can ask a lot of questions, but maybe you won't have answers.
Science doesn't have all the answers. We tend to think that science is very declarative, and it's not. And in fact, in my book, the letter O is for odds, because it is an odds game, and you kind of have to understand odds a little bit. And, you know, the N is for notebook, because it's really important to keep your own notes. You know, I started my own notes, especially when I was talking to my friends, but then with every doctor's appointment, my husband was there, and he kind of took over, because there was this moment where I realized, oh, I'm not this sort of, you know, distant journalist working on a story. This doctor is talking about me and my health. And I kind of, you know, just got into a spiral that I couldn't really concentrate in the same way. But, you know, it's very helpful for every stage so that you can be clear about what you were told and what might have changed the next time you go, or the questions to ask when you have a particular test or something like that. It's really, really important. You know, it's great to have doctors who are engaged in communicating with you, but you might not have that. And it's important to keep your own record.
That's Madalika Sika. She's the author of A Breast Cancer Alphabet. We're talking about breast cancer, and I wanted to bring some doctors into this conversation. As we said, the idea that doctors, of course, are our partners in all of this, especially when you get a cancer diagnosis. So I want to introduce two folks who are joining us now. Dr. Tim Gilligan is a medical oncologist with the Cleveland Clinic. He's the director of coaching for healthcare communication and worked with more than 5,000 doctors there on how they can communicate with patients. He's on the line from Cleveland. Dr. Gilligan, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And with me here in our studios in Chicago is Dr. April Swadoba. She's a clinical instructor and breast oncologist at the University of Chicago. Dr. Swadoba, thanks for being with us, too.
Thanks for having me.
So doctors get lots of training and supervision on, for example, surgery and technique. Dr. Gilligan, in your experience, do doctors get the same amount of training on how to communicate with patients?
That's starting to happen, but it's very recent. When I was in medical school, I remember having one lecture at noon about communication, and then you would practice in real time, but you wouldn't really be trained how to do it formally. You'd be trained how to organize the information, how to organize a history. And we've all experienced that as patients, that doctors take our information in an organized way. But in terms of how to have challenging conversations like this, how to deliver bad news, or how to explain complicated things, up until recently, there hasn't been much training. Medical schools have started to change that. So I think future generations of doctors will be better prepared for these conversations.
And Swoboda, I'm used to calling you April, but I should need to call you Dr. Swoboda on the air. You actually had a whole class in school. You went to Brown University. It was called doctoring. What did you do in that class?
So in our doctoring class, it was kind of funny because we thought, you know, we're going to medical school, so aren't we going to learn how to be doctors? But our doctoring class actually focused on patient communication, history taking. So in addition to the actual clinical aspects of learning how to gather the appropriate information from patients to make the correct diagnosis, we learned about very basic things about how to communicate with patients, addressing them by their proper titles, breaking bad news, all sorts of things.
And I wonder, Dr. Gilligan, how common is it at medical schools that they have classes like this?
It's becoming much more the standard now. They have defined basic competencies for physicians, and communication skills are now one of those core competencies. So, again, I think in modern medical schools, this is becoming a regular thing where people get to practice under supervision. They're given some best practices, and then they get to try them out. And I think one of the important realizations is that this isn't a cognitive learning. This is a motor skill. So similar to if you were learning how to ski or how to play tennis, you wouldn't sit in a lecture hall. They put you on the mountain. They put skis on your feet, and you have to go down the mountain, and you fall down a lot, but people tell you how to do better, and you improve through practice. And medical schools are more and more incorporating that, where students can practice and get feedback and get better. But many practicing physicians now never had that opportunity, so they were thrown into this and said, figure it out, use your interpersonal skills. And they weren't really given best practices or how to do it effectively. They were expected to figure it out on their own, and some are good at it and some aren't. But I think what we've learned is that training really can improve people's performance in communication, just as it can improve people's performance at other motor skills. And so I'm optimistic about the future, but we have a lot of work to do.
Well, and I think even things have changed. Madalika, you and I were talking about how the difference your diagnosis was in 2010. You know, mine was in February. And one thing that I noticed that I thought was just there are very simple things that all of my doctors did, which was after I was examined, they never let me sit in my gown. They said, why don't you get dressed and then we'll talk? Or sometimes we even moved to a different room. And at one point I even was in a room with an oncologist and he said, oh, why are you wearing your gown? I don't need to examine you. We're just talking. He's like, let me go and you can change and then we can come back and we can talk. And I wonder, Dr. Swoboda, like those things, I mean, I think that really helps what kind of empowering patients too, right? Because you're not just sitting there in a gown and feeling so vulnerable and exposed. And that's, I think, is that probably more common practice now, you think?
Absolutely. We actually, in our doctoring class, had standardized patients, and we were kind of left to our own devices, and we would get feedback about things like that, being left in a gown or all sorts of different things. And it was very helpful because you might know the science, but there's exactly like Dr. Gilligan said, there's a lot of skill that needs to be practiced by actually interacting with patients and practicing giving them news. And having the ability to do that in a doctoring class and getting feedback was invaluable.
And what kind of feedback did you get?
So the feedback that I got was that I talked too fast and that I use too much technical jargon, too much medical language. I think that sometimes when I get nervous, as might be the case now, I tend to start talking fast and filling the space with information. And the feedback I got was that I needed to slow down and give the patient space to respond.
And Dr. Gilligan, how often are you able to do that now at the Cleveland Clinic, where you're actually doing coaching on looking at doctors and their actual communication and then able to provide them coaching tips afterwards?
So I that's what I do when I do coaching is I follow doctors around and I watch how they're practicing. I do it with our trainees. If they're in clinic with me, I'll sit and watch them talk to patients. And it opens up great opportunities to identify areas where we can do better. And I think one of the things that several people on this program have said in one way or another is I think there's a movement towards a more partnering relationship between doctors and patients where we're both members of the healthcare team trying to address the patient's healthcare needs. And so it needs to be more of a conversation. And so, yes, if we talk too fast or if we use complicated terminology, the patient may not understand, or we may dump a lot of information on the patient that isn't really what they want to know. So one of the things we're trying to move towards is really listening to the patient more and finding out what they want to know so that we can give them the information they need. Because just as I've heard frustration on this call that you have trouble getting the information you want, if the doctor comes in and just dumps 10-minute lecture of medical facts on you, it's hard to absorb that, and it's probably not what you need. So one of the things we try to teach is asking the patient what they want to know, what they already understand, what's most important to them, figure out who we're talking to so that we can tailor it. But this two-wayness is very important. It's a partnership. We're trying to flatten the hierarchy in a lot of ways, and I think that's where care is best, when the doctor is providing, or the other clinician, the medical expertise, but the patient's providing the expertise and their experience and their values and their priorities and goals.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about breast cancer, about patient-doctor communication. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting World on the Horizon, Swahili Arts Across the Indian Ocean, the first U.S. traveling exhibition dedicated to the arts of the Swahili coast and their enduring connections around the world. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about breast cancer, and not just my experience with my diagnosis of breast cancer earlier this year, but about the issue of doctor and patient communication. My guests are fellow journalist Madalika Sika. She's the author of A Breast Cancer Alphabet. She's also PBS's public editor. Dr. Timothy Gilligan is with us from Cleveland. He's at the Cleveland Clinic, where he's a medical oncologist. He's also the director of coaching for healthcare communication. Dr. April Swoboda is also with us. She's at the University of Chicago Medicine, where she's also a clinical instructor and breast oncologist. Just before the break, we were talking about, Dr. Gillian, we're talking about the whole idea of flattening the hierarchy. And Madalika, I just wanted to ask you a question. After you wrote your book, you gave it to your doctors. What was their response? What did they learn from your experience as a patient? I'm curious.
Well, I think they learned a lot of things that they just take for granted that they don't actually think about in the context of the patient. You know, one of the letters in my book is I for indignities, and all the indignities one goes through with breast cancer, from, you know, your breast becoming very public property, being photographed and touched and needles inserted, and a lot of pain, and all these things which they are just doing as part of their doctoring but never really thought about it from the point of view of the patient. And, you know, because the chances are, I mean, none of my doctors themselves had ever had cancer or breast cancer or had a mastectomy. So they can give you their best input as a doctor, but not from living the experience. So I think, you know, that was one thing that they all commented on. They're like, oh, wow, I really didn't think about it from that point of view.
Dr. Gilligan, one of the things I know that you have sort of three kind of main points that you hit on with your coaching, and one of those is relationships and empathy. In a way, I imagine it must be really hard. Dr. Swoboda, you and I talked about this. You know, that first meeting with a doctor, for us, it's our first time with a doctor talking about our cancer. That's your job. You do that 10 to 15 times a day. Dr. Gilligan, how do you, I mean, that's a really tough thing for doctors to, how do you sort of train and coach doctors to think about all of these things as just a daily part of their job, the empathy and having that as part of every single meeting that they go through, which I imagine that's also emotionally draining for doctors.
I think it's a two-edged sword, because it's also partly why we go into medicine. If you talk to people going into oncology, why are you becoming a cancer doctor? And I've interviewed hundreds of these people, they almost always say, the vast majority will say, it's because of the relationship with the patient. So we are drawn to this human contact, and yes, if it's bad news, that's draining, but there's also something deeply enriching about working on serious issues with people and helping them. Even if we can't provide a cure, there's still things we can do to help. What first drew me into the work is very similar to what was just mentioned, which is that I was watching our trainees talk to patients, and I felt like you guys are not trying to imagine what it's like to have a doctor tell you you have cancer and how upsetting that is and how scary it is. They were talking as if they were explaining medical concepts to another physician. And so I really, that's how I first got into this work, was trying to get them to not just present the medical facts, but to try to imagine, what's it like to sit in the patient's chair? What's it like when they leave the office and they go home and they have all this stuff to deal with that we've just, in a sense, given to them in terms of the medical news? But I think when you do it well, it's what makes you want to go to work the next day, is you feel like you're doing real, meaningful human work. And it's draining, just like any real work is, but it's also enriching, and you find ways to recharge your batteries, which is important, or else people will burn out. Burnout's a big issue. But I don't think avoiding this stuff is the way you avoid burnout. I think it's by, in a sense, diving into it and embracing it. And I think flattening the hierarchy can help, in that if we don't take on more responsibility than we need to, if we realize the patient has some responsibility and we work together on a shared challenge, that also, I think, is a healthier way for both physicians and patients to work on these diagnoses.
And I think it's really hard when you get a cancer diagnosis and everyone says, you know, every person's cancer is different and people approach things differently, especially in terms of how much information they want. Not everyone is going to be a journalist who's going to get all of the most accurate, especially public media journalists, who are going to get the most accurate information they can and make sure it's from the right source. And I wonder, Dr. Swoboda, what do you do when a patient, because there is, and I've encountered a lot of people who said to me, why didn't the doctor make the decision for you? When there are points that, there were points in my, over the past 8 months where there are decisions that we had to make together. How do you figure, I wonder how you navigate that as a doctor, trying to figure out, maybe this patient doesn't want a lot of information. How do I empower them?
Sure. You know, I say to my patients from the very beginning that we are in a partnership, and I have a lot of medical information, but like has been said before, the patient is the only person that's an expert in their own health and their own experience. And I ask my patients, I try to elicit very clearly from them how much information they want, what information they want specifically, when they want it, and then we kind of go from there.
And you also have experience as you're a doctor, Dr. Swoboda, but you also have experience on the other side of this with your family. You're a mom, you're a doctor. You're, as a mom, you've had experience with your daughter. I wonder, receiving medical treatment, did that change how you approached your patients?
Absolutely. I've had two kind of seminal experiences back in 2008. My dad had a kidney transplant when I was a second-year medical student. And then earlier this year, my daughter was in the intensive care unit with severe asthma, and it absolutely changed my way, my approach. I think Masika had mentioned, you know, you can never imagine what it's like to be on the receiving end of that type of information unless you've actually been in that situation. And I remember when my daughter was in the hospital, everything kind of turned to mush, and people would explain things to me that I know that I understand because I'm a physician, but I would forget it immediately. And it was very overwhelming. And I can't imagine what it must be like for a patient who does not have a medical background. And so when I'm meeting my patients, I say to them, I fully expect that you're going to forget half of what I'm telling you. I understand that it must be very, very overwhelming, and I'm here for you. And we just kind of go from there. I let the patient kind of lead the way that we are going to have our interaction.
Metallica, do you think there are also generational or cultural differences among patients in terms of their ability to speak up or say, I don't know or I don't understand?
I think there are some generational and, frankly, some sort of class distinctions as well. You know, I think that there are people who feel like, oh, well, this doctor is, you know, very learned and educated and they know what they're doing. I think for us, our primary care physician is our age, and I think that made the big difference because we could talk to her as a peer almost. And it was the same with my other surgeons, you know, and I think that we connected on that level, which was very useful. And, you know, they were really small things that they did that were actually big things that they did because we were able to communicate. And I remember after my first meeting with the first doctor I saw, who was the breast surgeon, you know, our daughters were 11 and 13 at the time. And, you know, at the end of our meeting, she said, you know, if you would like to bring your daughters in so I can explain to them in a way they can understand what's going on, I'm happy to do that. And I thought that that was just a, you know, a wonderful offer that I, you know, don't think doctors make very often, but I think she was coming from the same place as I was. So I think it's really important to try and get over your sense of, oh my God, the doctor knows everything. Well, the doctor knows everything about X. You may know things about Y, and certainly the doctor doesn't know about you and your life and your circumstances, and you have to help the doctor understand that too in the same way that the doctor is helping you understand about your health.
Dr. Gilligan, one final question for you. As someone who's training the next generation of doctors to communicate well, we have one of those next generation doctors here with Dr. Swoboda. Do you feel optimistic that we're getting better at this?
Yes, I do for sure. I see it. I'm really impressed with the current graduates from medical school and the people in residency now at how much of this stuff they have learned, and I think they're doing better, and I'm very optimistic about the future. This is going to continue to get attention.
Thanks so much for being with me. That's Dr. Timothy Gilligan with the Cleveland Clinic. I want to thank University of Chicago's Dr. April Swoboda and Madalika Sika. She's the author of A Breast Cancer Alphabet. All of you, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last year, farmers across Arkansas and Missouri went into crisis mode after watching their healthy crops become stunted and sickly. The culprit was dicamba. That's a weed killer commercialized decades ago that's been gaining renewed popularity. Despite its documented damage in neighboring states, more than a few agricultural experts felt that Illinois farmers could reintroduce dicamba without issue. But now, as growers throughout the state carry on with the 2017 harvest, it's safe to say that did not happen. As many as 600,000 acres of Illinois soybeans have been injured by dicamba. That's according to a survey out from the University of Missouri. Jonathan Hedinger has been covering the dicamba disaster for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. He's going to join us shortly. But first, I'd like to welcome Joe Zumwalt, who farms 3,000 acres of corn and soybean. He's joining us from Hancock County that borders Iowa and Missouri. Also on the line is University of Illinois weed scientist Aaron Hager. He's in Urbana. Joe, Aaron, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you. Joe, let's start with you. You haven't experienced any damage personally, but you've seen it at neighboring farms. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as driving through the countryside, it's obvious because we have used the chemistry for a number of years on corn. But only this year, obviously, this is the first year that it has been legally allowed to be used in broad areas over soybeans that are bred with the tolerant trait of dicamba. And so we're seeing a little bit more widespread use of the product. And as a result of that, we are seeing various types of injury occurring. to various degrees. Not all are yield-impacting injury, but there is injury, and it's noticeable, and it has occurred for a number of reasons.
Aaron, can you tell us a little bit about those reasons? You wrote about this back in July for U of I. What is dicamba, what is it doing?
Well, there are several, actually, routes of exposure that sensitive soybean, by which they can be exposed to dicamba. For example, you could have exposure due to physical drift or movement of spray particles that take place during the application. You may also expose soybean through residues, dicamba residues that are left in application equipment from moving from one field to a sensitive field. And you can also have movement of dicamba either through what's called a temperature inversion condition or through the process, a chemical process called volatilization, where the liquid form actually changes to a gas and then moves from the treated area.
And this is something, Aaron, dicamba is actually older. It's actually an older herbicide. It was commercialized nearly 50 years ago. If it's been around all this time, why are we hearing about so many problems now in 2017?
Well, we've had issues of dicamba movement onto sensitive soybean literally for 50 years. What the big difference is in 2017 now is that with the planting of several million acres of dicamba-resistant soybean varieties, now in 2017, when we were using dicamba, we were literally using it at a time of year that we typically have never done it before. We typically would use dicamba in corn at very early growth stages in corn, generally speaking, when air temperatures were quite a bit lower than what they generally are when we post-apply herbicides in soybeans. And obviously, a lot of the process around volatility, for example, is dependent on temperature. The higher the temperature, typically more volatility occurs. And so if you would poll Midwestern weed scientists, say last December, about what issues of dicamba might we expect to see in 2017, I suspect all of them would have basically said the same thing. We're going to see instances of off-target movement, whether it's through volatility or the other possible avenues, but nobody really fully understood or could even guesstimate what the scope or what the extent would be, as it turned out to be here in 2017.
Joe, as a farmer, I wonder if you can walk us through, for those of us who don't farm, what your thought process is when you're thinking about pesticides. How does dicamba compare? Why would people pick that?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I guess I would stress is how important it is for us to maintain this product within our toolbox of products that we can use, because so many producers throughout the Midwest are having extreme difficulty with intense weed pressures. And we keep as an industry, we have to continue to come up with new chemistries so that way we can adequately control the weeds in the fields and have clean fields, and that results in a lot of other positive things. So we saw that with Roundup when it became widespread use 20 years ago. It was a great tool in the toolbox because it had great weed control. And over time, those products do develop some weed resistance and weed tolerance. And so we're constantly needing new chemistries. And so that I would stress that how important it is for us to maintain this product. At the same time, as a producer, we have to make sure that we understand exactly what the doctor was speaking of when it comes to inversion and volatilization. It's a very different type of chemistry that we're using. We've used it for a number of years in corn, but now we're using it at different times of the year, later times of the year, where when it volatilizes can cause more alternative drift or injury to other areas. And so for me as a producer, it's vital to maintain that product in my toolbox. So if I have a situation that makes it necessary for me to use, that I can continue to use it.
We're going to come back. We're going to take a quick break here. But when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation that we're having about dicamba. It's actually based on our conversation today was actually inspired by the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. When we come back, Jonathan Hettinger is going to join us. You can read his reporting online about this. We're going to tweet it out. Follow 21ST Show. You can also go to midwest.org. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Joe Zumwalt Hager, weed scientist and reporter Jonathan Hettinger. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the herbicide dicamba and the problems that it's causing, the widespread damage. As many as 600,000 acres of Illinois soybeans have been injured by dicamba. We've got a couple folks talking about that now, including University of Illinois weed scientist Aaron Hager. Aaron, so when we're looking at all of this damage, and I just gave that number throughout the Midwest, the estimate is actually closer to 3 million. We've talked a little bit about how this damage has happened, the time of year, the application. Do we think that dicamba is more unpredictable than other pesticides?
No, not necessarily. Like I said, these are issues that have been known since the inception, since the molecule was first derived back in the 1960s. It's inherently a volatile molecule. We've known that for years. So really, we've gone through several different iterations of different formulations of dicamba. And to some extent, it's simply a lot of this, why we talk about this, why we talk about the scope of the unintentional and untargeted movement of dicamba is simply because soybean are one of the most sensitive species to dicamba that there is. And it's been shown in research recently published from the University of Missouri, it only takes about 1/20,000th of a field use rate could actually affect a soybean plant to where visually it expresses the symptoms of exposure.
Jonathan Hedinger is with us as well. He's in our Urbana studios. He's a reporter for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, so what did you find when you reviewed all of these complaints that were filed with the Illinois Department of Agriculture?
So we were looking at it in terms of formal complaints, and we found out that there were only 239 formal complaints with dicamba across the state of Illinois. But that was still more than any other year in recent years in terms of all different herbicides. But it really pales in comparison to the number of acres damaged, which is upwards of 600,000.
We actually just got an email from a listener. Jane in Northern Illinois says her crops and trees were affected by the farm across the street. And when she and her husband filed a complaint with the Illinois Department of Agriculture, an official was sent out to assess damage. But she's had a really hard time finding out any more information about the long-term effects of dicamba. She says it's because there's so many complaints that hers hasn't been gotten to yet. Jonathan, does that sound typical to you?
Well, the people I've been talking to have said that it's usually takes a few months for them to get a response. A biologist I talked to has been filing complaints across the state. Lou Nelms said he filed a complaint in May and he just got the response a few weeks ago. So I think that that's pretty typical. It just takes a while to kind of determine what caused this. And I just think that they do have more complaints this year. So it just kind of takes a little bit longer.
And Aaron, what do we know about long-term effects, especially on, for example, trees like oak trees?
Well, long-term effects really are going to depend on several factors. Number one, of course, the species of tree, as some tend to be more sensitive than others, but also the dose of the exposure. And that's something that we really don't know anytime that off-target exposure takes place, because we can visually see symptoms of exposure on some, you know, for example, on something like soybean. But yet if we would actually try to submit a tissue sample in for a laboratory analytical analysis, there's a very good likelihood that it would be below detectable level. Mm. So the long-term consequences are very, very difficult to predict.
I should note to our audience, as the 21st show, we did reach out to Monsanto. They produced dicamba to join us. The St. Louis company asked us for details, which we provided, but then they didn't respond. Jonathan, what has Monsanto said to you about all of this?
So basically, in their public comments and kind of what they've said to me is that that they stand by that this version of dicamba has lower volatility, and that they are working with people to make sure that they can still use it in the future and make sure people know how to apply dicamba. And then also they've kind of, at the beginning of the year, they were talking about kind of how it might be other forms of dicamba that aren't labeled that are sold by other companies, but that applicators through the Illinois Fertilizer and Chemical Association said that they really don't believe that that's an issue.
Joe, I just wanted to wrap up this conversation with you because obviously as a farmer, the whole idea is that you're, you know, you want to be careful about herbicide-resistant super weeds. You are balancing this with you don't, you know, you need to put this as your job to get weeds out of these, to get it out of your crop. How do you think farmers strike that balance, Joe?
Well, I think we have some good choices to make, but luckily we have a lot of options and a lot of information today. When you look at this dicamba issue, we've done so much more research on dicamba and the issues that the doctors brought up about the volatilization and the inversion. We have two companies, BASF and Monsanto, who are producing these products, and they've made the new versions of this chemistry so much safer than previous models, previous formulations. And so we as an industry feel that, you know, this product is going to continue to get safer, and we're going to continue to learn more about the weather conditions that give us the challenges for this product, about how to avoid them. And that's all part of what the EPA had put forth in USDA when they gave us a 2-year temporary permit on this product, is to try to develop the rules and guidelines under which we use it. And I do expect, you know, even in production agriculture here, that is intensively reviewed going forward this year. But I would also say, as we've talked about the claims that we're discussing here, as a producer, while numerous fields were affected, we're finding that a vast majority of those are having little to no yield impact. And I couldn't speak to the trees and things like that. I'm by no means an expert in that. But as far as our crop injury, when we talk about that, we're not just talking about complete loss. It ranges from a minor injury to, yes, there are cases where there are complete injury to the susceptible soybean plants. So there's a lot yet to be learned, but I think we just need to have some faith in the companies that bring us the products that they bring us, and know that it's through a regulated process by which they bring us the rules and regulations and products so that we have a safe product out here to use.
Jonathan, do you have a sense that states are taking regulatory action? Are we looking at anything on that level?
I think it's kind of still being determined. Arkansas has proposed a ban on the use of dicamba after April 15th. It's unclear whether that will happen. I mean, the other states have started to look at taking more action, Missouri and Tennessee specifically. But I think that the federal EPA is probably going to change some things going forward in 2018, but they haven't said exactly what. But I do think that there will likely be more regulatory action. And I also just wanted to mention that anyone interested in the issues with oak trees, we published a new story this morning about some of those issues in Illinois, Iowa, and Tennessee on our site.
Yeah, so that website is investigatemidwest.org. I want to thank Jonathan Hettinger for joining us. I want to also thank Joe Zumwalt and Aaron Hager. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
What a pleasure.
On Mondays, we like to talk state politics, wrap everything up, and there's a lot going on. Joining us is NBC5 Chicago's political reporter, Mary Ann Ahern. Hey, Mary Ann, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Sure. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. So yesterday, Mary Ann, you moderated a forum of Democratic candidates for governor, and I imagine this is a bit similar to the field of Republican candidates during last year's presidential primary, right? Can you remind us how many there are and who these candidates are?
Oh, my goodness. There were 7 at the forum yesterday, and it was sponsored by about 50 different group of progressive groups, but it was held at the Chicago Teachers Union. There were a big crowd, an estimated crowd of more than 1,000 were there to hear it. So that was in itself very interesting to me, that folks are engaged and want to
so
hear
early.
It.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, and, you know, to get everyone to get their say in less than 2 hours, you know, it was 1 to 3 in the afternoon. And maybe everyone didn't get as much equal time, but, you know, the Pritzker, Kennedy, Biss, Pawar, those four clearly the in lead, as well as Superintendent Diver from downstate, P.O. Hardiman, and Alex Petarakis. So 7 of the Democrats all there fielding lots of different questions.
Well, and before we get to the issues they talk about, obviously all of them are hoping to unseat Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, who's still dealing with the fallout from members of his own party after signing HB 40, which allows abortion to be covered under state employee insurance and under Medicaid, and ensures that abortions will remain legal in Illinois if Roe versus Wade were to be overturned. Marianne, I want to ask you about this because last week, State Senator Jason Barrickman said that Governor Rauner has essentially lost all of his influence over Republicans in the legislature. Why does it feel like so many Republicans seem betrayed by this when Governor Rauner ran on office and said he wouldn't have no social agenda? He's been pretty straightforward about his opinions on this from the beginning, I think.
But, you know, in April, he considered a veto and told folks, and especially the members of his party who were looking for this, he said, I might veto. I wish I had the exact quote, but definitely gave the idea that he would consider a veto of this bill, which brought a lot of his core supporters, you know, to him as he was looking for it on various votes on other issues. So for him to have said one thing in 2014, another in April, and then back to his original position a couple of weeks ago, has left that core, very conservative group of the Republican Party abandoning him, really.
And then we also saw another staff shakeup in Governor Rauner's office after 88 days. This was last week. Former head of the Illinois Policy Institute, Christina Rasmussen, is out. I wonder where you think we're at, Marianne, right now with Governor Rauner, with his office. This is we've gone through a couple different rounds of people going in and out. It seems like there hasn't been, I wonder to your mind, how much stability you're seeing over the past 3 or 4 months for Governor Rauner?
Well, the grand experiment with the Illinois Policy Institute obviously did not work. Nearly everyone, I believe there might be one left, and who knows how long he will stay, but most of them have left. And when they came, it was the timing, yes, a tax increase was approved by the General Assembly. That is what he did not want. However, there was 80% of the press he received after the General Assembly voted for that tax hike was, well, he stuck to his guns, said he didn't want it, says he, you know, disapproves of this. And yet, rather than taking that as a perhaps plus for him, he reversed his course and said, I want all these people out. They advised me in the wrong way. And it was surprising. Well, here they are 3 months later, reversing that course. The folks he has chosen now, from what I hear from those who work inside the office, they see this as a positive move. They believe these are folks with experience of government, not folks who work at ivory towers and send out signals of, oh, my gosh, why aren't we doing this or that, and have no experience of what it's really like. So he's also got to gear up for his own reelection, which he hasn't officially announced yet, and we're still waiting to hear when that's going to be, perhaps this week, because within a couple of weeks, it's the veto session. So,
right.
Yes, I've been told he's definitely running again, but now he might have a primary opponent, and his office has been in disarray. So, yeah, he does really need to hit the reset button rather quickly.
Marianne, we're almost out of time. We've got less than a minute left, but just wanted to ask you really quickly then. That brings us back to the primary in March, possibly Governor Rauner facing a primary challenge. And then what do you think this is going to look like with this field of so many Democrats in the primary, 7 right now running against each other?
Right. You know, so Jeannie Ives, Representative Jeannie Ives from Wheaton, GOP Republican, is very much considering a race for governor. She's talking to folks. I think she's trying to find out, could she financially, who's going to back her? How much does she need in a primary? Primary voters are serious conservative voters in the Republican Party. She might do well in a primary. That's the Republican scenario. Democratic side, we have 8-some candidates. Will they all be candidates by the time we get to the even January 1? Perhaps a few might fall off. But it appears at this point it is a race of Kennedy versus Pritzker. The two of them are polling the highest. They seem to be at each other in yesterday's forum a bit on various issues, whether it was Speaker Madigan or property tax breaks. But many of them have the same core beliefs. It's just a matter of financially. And Pritzker is able to be a self-funder. Not that Kennedy doesn't have a lot of money himself, but hasn't put as much of his own financial fortune into it as Pritzker has.
Thanks to NBC5 from Chicago, political reporter Mary Ann Ahern. Lots to look forward to. Thanks for that, Mary Ann.
All right. Thank you. Talk to you again.
Before we end today, just a congratulations to University of Chicago economist Richard Thaler celebrating the Nobel Prize this morning, winning for an economist for his work in behavioral economics. He's one of 28 scholars from the University of Chicago who have received the Nobel Memorial Prize in economics. Again, the founder, one of the founders of behavioral economics, he said this morning when asked how he was going to spend the prize money, it's a funny question. I think I'm going to spend it as irrationally as possible. So congratulations to the University of Chicago for that. You've been listening to The 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boudou. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.